men and of women. At his best, he is marvellously readable, whether in the humorous pathos of Madame Tellier's Establishment, or in a horror story like The Horla, both of which I shall consider here. Frank O'Connor insisted that Maupassant's stories were not satisfactory when compared to those of Chekhov and Turgenev, but then few story writers rivaled the two Russian masters. O'Connor's real objection was that he thought the sexual act itself turns into a form of murder in Maupassant. A reader who has just enjoyed Madame Tellier's Establishment would hardly agree. Flaubert, who did not live to write it, wished to set his final novel in a provincial whorehouse, which his son had already done in this robust story. Everyone in Madame Tellier's Establishment is benign and amiable, which is part of the story's authentic charm. Madame Tellier, a respectable Norman peasant, keeps her establishment as one might run an inn or even a boarding school. Her five sex workers, as some call them now, are vividly, even lovingly described by Maupassant, who emphasizes the peace kept in the house by Madame's talent for conciliation and her incessant good humor. On an evening in May, none of the regular clients are in good humor because the establishment is festooned with a notice, "Closed for a first communion." Madame and her staff have gone off for this event, the celebrant being Madame's niece and goddaughter. The first communion develops into an extraordinary occasion, when the prolonged weeping of the whores, moved to remember their own girlhoods, becomes contagious, and the entire congregation is swept by an ecstasy of tears. The priest proclaims that the Holy Christ has descended, and particularly thanks the visitors, Madame Tellier and her staff. After a boisterous trip back to their establishment, Madame and her ladies return to their ordinary evening labors, performed, however, with more than the routine zest and in high good spirits. "It isn't every day we have something to celebrate," Madame Tellier concludes the story by remarking, and only a joyless reader declines to celebrate with her. For once, at least, Schopenhauer's disciple has broken loose from gloomy reflections on the close relations between sex and death. Exuberance in storytelling is hard to resist, and Maupassant never writes with more gusto than in Madame Tellier's Establishment. This tale of Normandy has warmth, laughter, surprise, and even a kind of spiritual insight. The Pentecostal ecstasy that burns through the congregation is as authentic as the weeping of the whores that ignites it. Maupassant's irony is markedly kinder, though less subtle, than his master Flaubert's. And the story is bawdy, not prurient, in the Shakespearean spirit. It enlarges life and diminishes no one. Maupassant's own life ended badly. By his late 20s, he was syphilitic. At 39, the disease affected his mind, and he spent his final years locked in an asylum after a suicide attempt. His most upsetting horror story, The Horla, has a complex and ambiguous relation to his illness and its consequences. The nameless protagonist of the story is perhaps a syphilitic going mad, though nothing that Maupassant narrates actually tells us to make such an inference. A first-person narration, The Horla gives us more clues than we can interpret, because we cannot understand the narrator, and do not know whether we can trust his impressions, of which we receive little or no independent verification. The Horla begins with the narrator, a prosperous young Norman gentleman, persuading us of his happiness on a beautiful May morning. He sees a splendid Brazilian three-master boat flow by his house and salutes it. This gesture evidently summons the Horla, an invisible being that we later learn has been afflicting Brazil with demonic possession and subsequent madness. Horlas are evidently refined cousins of the vampires. They drink milk and water and drain vitality from sleepers without actually drawing blood. Whatever has been happening in Brazil, we are free to doubt precisely what is going on in Normandy. Our narrator eventually sets fire to his own house to destroy his Horla, but neglects to tell the servants, who are consumed with their home. When the tale-teller apprehends that his Horla is still alive, he concludes by telling us that he will have to kill himself. Clearly, it is indeed his Horla, whether or not it made the voyage from Brazil to Normandy. The Horla is the narrator's madness, and not just the cause of madness. Has Maupassant written the story of what it means to be possessed by syphilis? At one point, the sufferer glances in the mirror and cannot see his reflection. Then he sees himself in a mist at the back of the mirror. The mist recedes until he sees himself completely, and of the mist or blocking agent he cries out, "I had seen him." The narrator says that the Horla's advent means that the reign of man is over. Magnetism, hypnotism, suggestion are all aspects of the Horla's will. "He has come," the victim cries out, and suddenly the interloper shouts his name in one's ears. "The Horla! He has come!" Maupassant invents the name Horla. Is it an ironic play upon the English word whore? That seems very remote, unless indeed Maupassant's venereal disease is the story's hidden center. The horror story is a large and fascinating genre in which Maupassant excelled, but never again as powerfully as in The Horla. I think that it is because, on some level, he knew that he prophesied his own madness and attempted suicide. Maupassant is not of the artistic eminence of Turgenev, Chekhov, Henry James, or Hemingway as a short story writer, but his immense popularity is well deserved. Someone who created both Madame Tellier's establishment, with its amiable ecstasies, and the Horla, with its convincing fright, was a permanent master of the story. Why read Maupassant? At his best, he will hold you as few others do. You receive pretty much what his narrative voice gives you. It is not God's plenty, but it pleases many and serves as an introduction to the more difficult pleasures of storytellers subtler than Maupassant. Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway's best short stories surpass even The Sun Also Rises, his only novel that seems now to be something more than a period piece. Wallace Stevens, the strongest of modern American poets, once termed Hemingway the most significant of living poets, so far as the subject of extraordinary reality is concerned. By poet here, Stevens meant the remarkable stylist of Hemingway's short stories, and by extraordinary reality, he meant a poetic realm in which consciousness takes the place of imagination. This high praise is merited by Hemingway's permanent achievements in the short story, some 15 or so masterpieces, easy to parody, frequently by Hemingway himself, but impossible to forget. Frank O'Connor, who disliked Hemingway as intensely as he liked Chekhov, remarks in The Lonely Voice that Hemingway's stories illustrate a technique in search of a subject, and therefore become a minor art. Let us see. Read the famous sketch called Hills Like White Elephants. 5 pages that are almost all dialogue between a young woman and her lover while they wait for a train at a station in a provincial Spanish town. They are continuing a disagreement as to the abortion he wishes her to undergo when they reach Madrid. The story catches the moment of her defeat and very likely of the death of their relationship. And that is all. The dialogue makes clear that the woman is vital and decent, while the man is a sensible emptiness, selfish and unloving. The reader is wholly with her when she responds to his, "I'd do anything for you," with, "Would you please, 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 please stop talking?" 7 pleases are a lot, but as repetition, they are precise and persuasive in Hills Like White Elephants. The story is beautifully prefigured in that simile of a title, Long and White, the hills across the valley of the Ebro look like white elephants to the woman, not to the man. White elephants, proverbial Siamese royal gifts to courtiers who would be ruined by the expense of their upkeep, become a larger metaphor for unwanted babies, and even more for erotic relationships too spiritually costly when a man is inadequate. Hemingway's personal mystique, his bravura poses as warrior, big-game hunter, bullfighter, and boxer, is as irrelevant to Hills Like White Elephants as its male protagonist's insistence that, "You know I love you." More relevant is the remark of Hemingway's surrogate, Nick Adams, in The End of Something, when he terminates a relationship. "It isn't fun anymore." I don't know many women readers who like that sentence, but it hardly is an apologia, only a very young man's self-indictment. The Hemingway story that wounds me most is another 5-pager, God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, which is almost entirely dialogue after its opening paragraphs, including an outrageous initial sentence. "In those days, the distances were all very different. The dirt blew off the hills that now have been cut down, and Kansas City was very like Constantinople." You can parody that by saying, "In those days, Bridgeport, Connecticut was very like Haifa." Still, we are in Kansas City on Christmas Day, and listening to the conversation between 2 physicians, the incompetent Dr. Wilcox, who relies upon a limp leather-indexed volume, The Young Doctor's Friend and Guide, and the mordant Doc Fisher, who begins by quoting his co-religionist Shylock, "What news along the Rialto?" The news is very bad, as we learn soon enough. A boy of about 16, obsessed with purity, had come into the hospital to ask for castration. Turned away, he had mutilated himself with a razor and will probably die from loss of blood. The interest of the story centers in Doc Fisher's lucid nihilism, prophetic of Nathaniel West's Shrike in Miss Lonely Hearts. "Ride you, doctor, on the day, the very anniversary of our Savior's birth?" "Our Savior? Ain't you a Jew?" Dr. Wilcox said. "So I am, so I am. It always is slipping my mind. I've never given it its proper importance. So good of you to remind me. Your Savior, that's right. Your Savior, undoubtedly your Savior. And the ride for Palm Sunday." "You, Wilcox, are the donkey upon whom I ride into Jerusalem," is the implication of that last phrase. Rancid and brilliant, Doc Fisher has peaked, as he says, into hell. His Shylockian intensity is a Hemingway-esque tribute to Shakespeare, described by Colonel Cantwell, Hemingway's surrogate, in Across the River and Into the Trees, as the winner and still the undisputed champion. When he is most ambitious in his stories, Hemingway is most Shakespearean, as in the famous quasi-autobiographical The Snows of Kilimanjaro, its author's favorite. Of the story's protagonist, the failed writer Harry, Hemingway observes, "He had loved too much, demanded too much, and he wore it all out." That would be a superb critical remark to make about King Lear, Hemingway's most admired character in all of Shakespeare. More than anywhere else, Hemingway attempts and achieves tragedy in the relatively brief compass of The Snows of Kilimanjaro. The meditation of a dying man, rather than the description of an action, this Baroque story is Hemingway's most intense self-chastisement, and I think that Chekhov himself, much given to that mode, would have been impressed by it. One doesn't think of Hemingway as a visionary writer, but The Snows of Kilimanjaro begins with an epigraph telling us that the snow-covered western summit of the mountain is called the House of God, and close to it is the carcass, dried and frozen, of a leopard. There is no explanation as to what a leopard could have been seeking nearly 20,000 feet above sea level. Very little is gained by saying that the leopard is a symbol of the dying Harry. Originally, in ancient Greek, a symbolon was a token for identification that could be compared to a counterpart. Commonly, we use symbol more loosely as something that stands for something else, whether by association or resemblance. If you identify the corpse of the leopard with Harry's lost but still residual ambition or aesthetic idealism as a writer, then you plunge Hemingway's story into bathos and grotesquerie. Hemingway himself did that in The Old Man and the Sea, but not in the masterful The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Harry is dying, slowly, of gangrene in an African hunting camp, surrounded by vultures and hyenas, palpably unpleasant presences that need not be interpreted as symbolic. Neither need the leopard be so interpreted. Like Harry, it is out of place, but the writer's vision of Kilimanjaro does seem another of Hemingway's nostalgic visions of a lost spirituality, qualified, as always, by a keen sense of nothingness, a Shakespearean nihilism. It seems useful to regard the uncanny presence of the dead leopard as a strong irony, a forerunner of Harry's vain quest to recover his identity as a writer at Kilimanjaro, rather than, say, at Paris, Madrid, Key West, or Havana. The irony is at Hemingway's own expense, insofar as Harry prophesies the Hemingway who, 19 days short of his 62nd birthday, turned a double-barreled shotgun on himself in the mountains of Idaho. Yet the story is not primarily ironical, and need not be read as a personal prophecy. Harry is a failed Hemingway. Hemingway, by being able to compose The Snows of Kilimanjaro, is precisely not a failure, at least as a writer. The best moment in the story is hallucinatory and comes just before the end. It is Harry's dying vision, though the reader cannot know that, until Harry's wife, Helen, realizes she can no longer hear him breathing. As he died, Harry dreamed that the rescue plane had come for him, but could carry only one passenger. On the visionary flight, Harry is taken up to see the square top of Kilimanjaro, great, high, and unbelievably white in the sun. This apparent image of transcendence is the most elusive moment in the story. It represents death and not the house of God. A dying man's phantasmagoria is not to be regarded as triumphal when the entire story conveys Harry's conviction that he has wasted his gifts as a writer. Yet Hemingway may have remembered King Lear's dying fantasy, in which the old mad king is persuaded that his beloved daughter Cordelia breathes again, despite her murder. If you love too much and demand too much, then you, like Lear and Harry, and at last Hemingway, will wear it all out. Fantasy for Harry takes the place of art. Hemingway was so wonderful and unexpected a story writer that I choose to end my account of him here with one of his unknown masterpieces, the splendidly ironic A Sea Change, which prefigures his posthumously published novel The Garden of Eden, with its portrayal of ambiguous sexualities. In A Sea Change, we are in a Parisian bar, where an archetypal Hemingway-esque couple are engaged in a crisp dialogue on infidelity. It takes the reader only a few exchanges to realize that the sea change of the title does not refer to the woman who is determined to begin or continue a lesbian relationship, yet wishes also to return to the man. It is the man who is suffering a sea change, presumably into the writer who will compose the rich and strange The Garden of Eden. "I'm a different man," he twice announces to the uncomprehending bartender after the woman has left. Looking into the mirror, he sees the difference, but what he sees we are not told, though he remarks to the bartender that vice is a very strange thing. It cannot be a consciousness of vice that has made him a different man. Rather, it is his imaginative yielding to the woman's persuasive defense that has altered him forever. "We're made up of all sorts of things. You've known that. You've used it well enough," she has said to him, and he tacitly acknowledges some crucial element in the sexuality they have shared. He suffers now a sea change, but nothing of him fades in this moment of only apparent loss. Almost too deft for irony, a sea change is a subtle self-recognition, an erotic autobiography remarkable for its indirection and its nuanced self-acceptance. Only the finest American master of the short story could have placed so much in so slight a sketch. Flannery O'Connor. D.H. Lawrence, a superb writer of short stories, gave the reader a permanent wisdom in one brief remark: trust the tale, not the teller. That seems to me an essential principle in reading the stories of Flannery O'Connor, who may have been the most original tale-teller among Americans since Hemingway. Her sensibility was an extraordinary blend of Southern Gothic and severe Roman Catholicism. So fierce a moralist is O'Connor that readers need to be wary of her tendentiousness. She has too palpable a design upon us to shock us by violence into a need for traditional faith. As teller, O'Connor was very shrewd, yet I think her best tales are far shrewder, and enforce no moral except an awakened moral imagination. O'Connor's South is wildly Protestant, not the Protestantism of Europe, but of the indigenous American religion, whether it calls itself Baptist, Pentecostal, or whatever. The prophets of that religion, snake handlers, free-thinking Christians, independent prophets, the swindlers, the mad, and sometimes the genuinely inspired, O'Connor named as natural Catholics. Except for this handful of natural Catholics, the people who throng O'Connor's marvelous stories are the damned, a category in which Flannery O'Connor cheerfully included most of her readers. I think that the best way to read her stories is to begin by acknowledging that one is among her damned, and then go on from there to enjoy her grotesque and unforgettable art of telling. A Good Man is Hard to Find remains a splendid introduction to O'Connor. A grandmother, her son and daughter-in-law, and their three children, are on a car journey when they encounter an escaped convict, the Misfit, and his two subordinate killers. Upon seeing the Misfit, the grandmother foolishly declares his identity, thus dooming herself and all her family. The old lady pleads with the Misfit while her family is taken away to be shot, but O'Connor gives us one of her masterpieces in this natural theologian of a killer. "Jesus," the Misfit declares, "thrown everything off balance, by raising the dead in a cosmos where there is no pleasure but meanness. Dizzy and hallucinating, the terrified grandmother touches the misfit while murmuring, "Why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children." He recoils, shoots her 3 times in the chest, and pronounces her epitaph. "She would have been a good woman if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life." The tale and the teller came together here, since the misfit clearly speaks for something fierce and funny in O'Connor herself. O'Connor gives us a hypocritical and banal old lady, and a killer who is, in O'Connor's view, an instrument of Catholic grace. This is meant to be, and certainly is, outrageous, because, being damned, we are outraged by it. We would be good, O'Connor thinks, if someone were there to shoot us every minute of our lives. Why do we not resent O'Connor's palpable designs upon us? Her comic genius is certainly part of the answer. Someone who can entertain us so profoundly can damn us pretty much as she pleases. In her Good Country People, we meet the unfortunate Joy Hopewell, who possesses both a Ph.D. in philosophy and a wooden leg, and the fancy first name Hulga, which she has given herself. A brash young Bible salesman, with the improbably phallic name of Manly Pointer, divests Hulga of her wooden leg in a haystack and then runs off with it. Hulga accurately knows herself as of the damned. Is she not a philosopher? And we can draw what moral we will from her cruelly hilarious fate. Shall we say of her, "She would have been a good woman if it had been somebody there to seduce her and run off with her wooden leg every minute of her life"? O'Connor would have disdained my skepticism, and I am aware that my parody is defensive. But her early stories, though lively, are not her greatest. That comes in such later work as A View of the Woods and Parker's Back, and in her second novel, The Violent Bear It Away. A View of the Woods is a sublimely ugly tale, featuring the 79-year-old Mr. Fortune and his 9-year-old granddaughter, Mary Fortune Pitts. Both are dreadful, selfish, stubborn, mean, sullen monuments of pride. At the story's end, a nasty fight between the two closes with the grandfather killing the little girl, having throttled her and smashed her head upon a rock. In his excitement and exhaustion, Mr. Fortune has a final view of the woods during a fatal heart attack. This is all grimly impressive, but how should we interpret it? O'Connor remarked that Mary Fortune Pitts was saved and Mr. Fortune damned, but she could not explain why, since they are equally abominable persons, and the death struggle might have gone either way. It is splendid that O'Connor was so outrageous because our skepticism outraged her and inspired her art. And yet her obsessive spirituality and absolute moral judgments cannot just sustain themselves at the reader's expense. But when I think that, I suddenly recall how close her literary tastes were to my own. She preferred Faulkner's As I Lay Dying and Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts to all other works of modern American fiction, and so do I. Reading Flannery O'Connor's stories and The Violent Bear It Away, I am exhilarated to the brink of fear, as I am by Faulkner and West in their grandest works, and by Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which surely O'Connor would have admired had she survived to read it. Turgenev and Chekhov, Maupassant and Hemingway were not ideologues, and the main tradition of the modern short story is certainly theirs, and not O'Connor's. And yet her verve and drive, the propulsive gusto of her comic spirit, is overwhelming. Her Catholicism might as well be holy rollerism, so far as the aesthetic effect of her fiction is concerned. There we can locate her natural shrewdness. Her mad and damned American religionists can be parodied. But the parody will not touch her assured Roman Catholicism. More than a comedian of genius, she had also the penetrating insight that religion, for her countrymen and women, was not the opiate, but rather the poetry of the people. Vladimir Nabokov. I pass on to a superb story by Vladimir Nabokov, The Vane Sisters, because the transition refreshes me, going from a vision of spirituality through violence to an aestheticism that plays with spiritualism. Nabokov was given to lamenting that his American English could never match the richness of his native Russian style, a lament that seems an irony when the reader confronts the baroquely rich textures of the Vane Sisters. Our narrator, himself French in origin, instructs in French literature at a New England women's college. Nabokovian through and through, this nameless narrator is a finicky aesthete, a harmless version of Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray. The Vane Sisters are Cynthia and Sybil, whose name and suicide are borrowed from Dorian Gray's victimized girlfriend, though both young women are more Henry Jamesian than Wildean, since they are evanescent and indirect personalities. The nameless French professor was the teacher of Sybil and the estranged close friend of Cynthia, but the lover of neither. The narrator begins with a chance hearing of Cynthia's death by heart attack. He is taking his usual Sunday afternoon stroll and stops to watch a family of brilliant icicles drip-dropping from the eaves of a frame house. A long paragraph is devoted to these icicles, and later he observes the lean ghost, the elongated umbra cast by a parking meter upon some damp snow, had a strange ruddy tinge. At the story's end, he wakes from a vague dream of Cynthia, but cannot unravel it. I could isolate, consciously, little. Everything seemed blurred, yellow-clouded, yielding nothing tangible. Her inept acrostics, maudlin evasions, theopathies, every recollection formed ripples of mysterious meaning. Everything seemed yellowly blurred, elusive, lost. The self-parody of Nabokov's own style here testifies that Sybil's acrostics are not as inept as Cynthia's. Work out the acrostic formed by the initial letters of this passage, and you get Icicles by Cynthia, Meter from Me, Sybil. Our narrator is haunted, then, by both women, but why? Probably because the Vane Sisters glided ghost-like through their existence anyway. Death seems hardly to alter them. But why the French professor as the object of these charmingly mischievous shades? It is possible that the narrator, being a Nabokovian self-parody, is being punished for Nabokov's own aestheticism and skepticism. Unlike Maupassant's The Horla, which represents a gathering madness, The Vane Sisters is an authentic, though highly original, ghost story. Sybil Vane, the day after taking a mid-year examination in French literature given by the narrator, kills herself in reaction to being abandoned by her married lover. We get to know the older sister, Cynthia, rather better after Sybil's death. Cynthia is a painter and a spiritualist and has evolved a theory of intervenient auras. These auras of the deceased intervene benignly in the lives of their survivors. After the narrator's skepticism alienates Cynthia, she accurately also calls him a prig and a snob, he breaks with her and forgets her until he is told of her death. Discreetly, she haunts him, until the climactic dream he cannot decipher, and the final acrostic, which we can. Nabokov's story, though brief, is replete with literary allusions to Emerson's transparent eyeball from his nature, and Coleridge's person from Porlock, who supposedly interrupted the composition of Kubla Khan. There are also vivid manifestations of Oscar Wilde and of Tolstoy at a séance, and an extraordinary general atmosphere of literary preciosity. What makes the Vane sisters magical is that the reader's own skepticism is overcome by the curious charm of these amiable women, whose existences and after-auras alike are so tenuous. The reader is separated by Nabokov from the narrator's priggishness, but not necessarily from his skepticism. Pragmatically, though, skepticism makes little difference here. These ghosts are persuasive precisely because they are so uninsistent upon persuasion. One doesn't think of the author of Pale Fire and Lolita as a Chekhovian writer. Nabokov adored Nikolai Gogol, whose spirit was fiercer and more lunatic than Chekhov's. But Cynthia and Sybil Vane would be at home in Chekhov. Like so many of his women, they represent the pathos of the unlived life. Nabokov, not much interested in pathos, prefers them as whimsical ghosts. Jorge Luis Borges. The modern short story, so long as it remains Chekhovian, is impressionistic. This is as true of James Joyce's Dubliners as it is of Hemingway or Flannery O'Connor. Perception and sensation, the aesthetic of Walter Pater, are centered in the impressionistic short story, including the major stories of Thomas Mann and Henry James. Something very different came into modern storytelling with the phantasmagoria of Franz Kafka, a prime precursor of Jorge Luis Borges, who can be said to have replaced Chekhov as the major influence upon the short stories of the second half of our century. Stories now tend to be either Chekhovian or Borgesian. Only rarely are they both. Borges's collected fictions insist always upon their self-conscious status as artifices, unlike Chekhov's impressionistic glances at the truths of our existence. The reader, encountering Borges and his many followers, is wise to entertain very different expectations than she brings to Chekhov and his vast school. One is not going to hear the lonely voice of a submerged element in the population, but rather a voice haunted by a plethora of literary voices, forerunners. What greater glory for a god than to be absolved of the world, is Borges's great outcry as he professes his Alexandrianism. If there is a god in Chekhov's stories, then he cannot be absolved of the world, nor can we. But for Borges, the world is a speculative illusion, or a labyrinth, or a mirror reflecting other mirrors. How to read Borges is necessarily more a lesson in how to read all his precursors than it is an exercise in self-understanding. That does not make Borges less entertaining or less enlightening than Chekhov, but it does make him very different. For Borges, Shakespeare is at once everyone and nobody. He is the living labyrinth of literature itself. For Chekhov, Shakespeare is obsessively the author of Hamlet, and Prince Hamlet becomes the ship in which Chekhov sails, quite literally in At Sea, the first story published under Chekhov's own name. Borges's relativism is an absolute. Chekhov's is conditional. The reader, enthralled by Chekhov and his disciples, can enjoy a personal relation to the story, but Borges enchants the reader into the realm of impersonal forces, where Shakespeare's own memory is a vast abyss into which one can tumble, losing whatever remnants exist of one's self. Of Borges's fictions, every reader will create a select list. Mine includes Tlön, Ugbar, Orbis Tertius, Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, Death and the Compass, The South, The Immortal, and The Elephi. Of this half-dozen, I will center here only upon the first, in some detail, so as to help culminate this section on how to read the short story, and why we need to go on reading the best examples of it that we can find. Talon, Ugbar, Orbis Tertius begins with a disarming sentence, in Andrew Hurley's eloquent translation. I owe the discovery of Ugbar to the conjunction of a mirror and an encyclopedia. That sentence is the purest Borges. Add a labyrinth to a mirror and an encyclopedia, and you would have his world. Of all Borges's fictions, Talon, Ugbar, Orbis Tertius is the most sublimely outrageous. And yet the reader is seduced into finding the incredible credible because of Borges's skill at employing real people, his best and most literary friends, and places, a big old country house, the National Library, a familiar hotel. The reader grants the same natural reality to the fictive Herbert Ashe as to the actual Bioy Casares, while Ugbar and Talon, though phantasmagorias, seem little more marvelous than the National Library. An encyclopedia that deals entirely with an invented world goes a long way towards verifying that world simply because it is an encyclopedia, a work to which we are accustomed to grant authority. This is disconcerting, but in a diverting way. As Talonian objects and concepts spread through the nations, reality caves in. Borges's dry irony is never more imposing. The truth is, it wanted to cave in. 10 years ago, any symmetry, any system with an appearance of order, dialectical materialism, anti-Semitism, Nazism, could spellbind and hypnotize mankind. Borges, a firm opponent both of Marxism and of Argentine fascism, indicts what we call reality, but not his fantasy of Talon, which is part of the living labyrinth of imaginative literature. Talon may well be a labyrinth, but it is a labyrinth forged by men, a labyrinth destined to be deciphered by men. That is to say, Talon is a benign labyrinth where no minotaur waits at the end of the maze to devour us. Canonical literature is neither a symmetry nor a system, but a hugely proliferating encyclopedia of human desire, the desire to be more imaginative rather than to hurt another self. We are not to be spellbound nor hypnotized by Talon, and yet, as readers, we are not given nearly enough information to decipher it. Talon remains precisely a vast cipher, to be solved only by the entire literary universe of Fantasia. Borges's story begins when he and his closest friend, and sometime collaborator, the Argentine novelist Bioy Casares, sit too late at dinner in Borges's rented country house, and together behold themselves in a mirror which unsettles them. Bioy remembers a saying that he attributes to one of the heresiarchs of Ugbar. Mirrors and copulation are abominable, for they multiply the number of mankind. We are never told the identity of this Gnostic ascetic, who necessarily is Borges himself, but Bioy thinks he found the saying in an article on Ugbar in what purported to be a reprint, under another title, of the 1902 Encyclopedia Britannica. The article does not appear in the edition available in Borges's rented house. The next day, Bioy brings his own relevant volume, which contains 4 pages on Ugbar. The geography and history of Ugbar are alike rather vague. The location appears to be Transcaucasian, while the literature of Ugbar is wholly fantasy and refers to imaginary realms, including Talon. There the story, barely begun, would end, but for the aptly named Herbert Ashe, a reticent British engineer with whom Borges says he had desultory conversations across 8 years at a hotel both frequented. After Ashe's death, Borges finds a volume that the engineer had left in the hotel bar. A First Encyclopedia of Talon, Volume 11, Clare to Yanger. The book has no place or date of publication and contains 1,001 pages, in clear allusion to the Arabian Nights. Absorbing these mythical pages, Borges discovers much of the nature, to call it that, of the cosmos that is Talon. Bishop Berkeley's fierce philosophical idealism, with its conviction that nothing could be like an idea except another idea, is the primordial law of existence on Talon. There are no causes or effects in that cosmos. The psychology and metaphysics of absolute fantasy prevail. Such was Talon Ugbar Orbis Tertius in 1940, another item in Borges's Anthology of Fantastic Literature. A postscript, dated 1947, expands on the phantasmagoria. Talon is explained as a benign conspiracy of hermetists and cabalists across 3 centuries, but one that took its decisive turn in 1824, when the reclusive millionaire Ezra Buckley proposed that an imaginary country be converted into an invented universe. Borges sets the proposal in Memphis, Tennessee, thereby making what we now think of as Elvis Land as mysterious as ancient Memphis, Egypt. The 40 volumes of the First Encyclopedia of Talon are completed by 1914, the year that saw the onset of World War I. In 1942, in the midst of World War II, the first objects from Talon begin to appear. A magnetic compass whose dial letters are in a Talonian alphabet, a small metal cone of unbearable weight, the discovery in a Memphis library of a complete set of the encyclopedia. Other objects made of unearthly material flood the nations. Reality caves in, and the world in time will be Talon. Borges, little moved, stays in his hotel, slowly revising a Baroque translation of Sir Thomas Browne's Urn Burial, of which my own favourite sentence remains, "Life is a pure flame, and we live by an invisible sun within us." Borges, a sceptical visionary, charms us even as we accept his warning. Reality caves in all too easily. Our individual fantasies may not be as elaborate as Talon, nor as abstract, yet Borges has sketched a universal tendency and fulfilled a fundamental yearning as to why we read. Tommaso Landolfi. Dostoevsky famously said, "We all came out from under Gogol's overcoat." A short story concerning a wretched copying clerk whose new overcoat is stolen. Disdained by the authorities, to whom he duly protests, the poor fellow dies, after which his ghost continues to search vainly for justice. Good as the story is, it is not the best of Gogol, which may be Old World Landowners, or the insane The Nose, which begins when a barber at breakfast discovers a customer's nose inside a loaf of bread freshly baked by his wife. The spirit of Gogol, subtly alive in much of Nabokov, achieves its apotheosis in the triumphant Gogol's Wife by the modern Italian story writer Tommaso Landolfi, perhaps the funniest and most unnerving story that I've yet read. The narrator, Gogol's friend and biographer, reluctantly tells us the story of Gogol's wife. The actual Gogol, a religious obsessive, never married, and deliberately starved himself to death at 43 or so, after burning his unpublished manuscripts. but Landolfi's Gogol, who might have been invented by Kafka or by Borges, has married a rubber balloon, a splendidly inflatable dummy who assumes different shapes and sizes at her husband's whim. Much in love with his wife, in one of her forms or another, Gogol enjoys sexual relations with her and bestows upon her the name Caracas, after the capital of Venezuela, for reasons known only to the mad writer. For some years all goes well, until Gogol contracts syphilis, which he rather unfairly blames upon Caracas. Ambivalence towards his silent wife gains steadily in Gogol through the years. He accuses Caracas of self-gratification and even betrayal, so that she becomes bitter and excessively religious. Finally, the enraged Gogol pumps too much air into Caracas, quite deliberately, until she bursts and scatters into the air. Collecting the remnants of Madame Gogol, the great writer burns them in the fireplace, where they share the fate of his unpublished works. Into the same fire, Gogol casts also a rubber doll, the son of Caracas. After this final catastrophe, the biographer defends Gogol from the charge of wife-beating and salutes the memory of the writer's lofty genius. The best prelude or postlude to reading Landolfi's Gogol's Wife is to read some stories by Gogol, on the basis of which we will not doubt the reality of the unfortunate Caracas. She is as likely a paramour as Gogol could ever have discovered or invented for himself. In contrast, Landolfi could hardly have composed much the same story and called it Maupassant's wife, let alone Turgenev's wife. No, it has to be Gogol and Gogol alone, and I rarely doubt Landolfi's story, particularly just after each rereading. Caracas has a reality that Borges neither seeks nor achieves for his Toulon. As Gogol's only possible bride, she seems to me the ultimate parody of Frank O'Connor's insistence that the lonely voice crying out in the modern short story is that of the submerged population. Who could be more submerged than Gogol's wife? Italo Calvino. Other masters of the short story are considered elsewhere in the volume, whether as novelists, Henry James and Thomas Mann, or poets, D. H. Lawrence. Here I wish to close with another great Italian fabulist, Italo Calvino, who died in 1985. My favorite among his books, really a universal favorite, is Invisible Cities, translated beautifully by William Weaver in 1974. A description of Calvino's invention, if rendered properly, could show others how and why Invisible Cities should be read and reread. Marco Polo is the tale-teller, and the venerable Kublai Khan his audience, as we listen also to stories about imaginary cities. The stories are only a page or two long, yet they are short stories in the Borgesian or Kafkan rather than the Chekhovian mode. Marco Polo's cities never were, and never could be, and yet most readers would go there, if only we might. Calvino's Invisible Cities come in 11 groupings, scattered rather than bunched. Cities and memory, desire, signs, eyes, names, the dead, the sky, as well as thin cities, trading cities, continuous cities, and hidden cities. Though one can become dizzy keeping all these in mind, it will not do to say that each of these cities is actually the same place. Since they are all named for women, that would amount to saying that all women are one woman, the doctrine of the Spanish philosopher-novelist Miguel de Unamuno, but not Calvino's view. Kublai Khan, listening to Marco Polo, would certainly agree with Calvino and Polo, and not with Unamuno. for Kublai, old and weary of power, finds in Marco Polo's visionary cities a pattern that will endure after his own empire is dust. Nostalgia for lost illusions, loves that never quite were, happiness perhaps only tasted, these are the emotions Calvino evokes. In Isadora, one of the cities of memory, the foreigner hesitating between two women always encounters a third. But alas, you can arrive at Isadora only in old age. You leave Tamara without having discovered it. And in Zirma, you see a girl walking with a puma on a leash. Kublai, after many recitals, begins to note a family resemblance among the cities, but that means only that the emperor is learning how to interpret Polo's art of narrative. There is no language without deceit. In Armilla, one of the thin cities, the only activity seems to be that of nymphs bathing. In the morning you hear them singing. This is bettered by a voluptuous vibration constantly stirs Chloe, the most chaste of cities. This is akin to one of Marco Polo's principles as a storyteller. Falsehood is never in words, it is in the things. Kublai protests that from then on he will describe the cities, and Marco Polo will then journey to see if they exist. But Marco denies Kublai's archetypal city and proposes instead a model made up only of exceptions, exclusions, incongruities, contradictions. The reader begins to understand that the true story is the ongoing debate between the visionary Marco and the skeptical Kublai, perpetual youth against eternal age. And so the recital goes on. Esmeralda, where cats, thieves, illicit lovers move along higher, discontinuous ways, dropping from a rooftop to a balcony. Or Eusapia, a city of the dead, where a girl with a laughing skull milks the carcass of a heifer. Wearying even of this, Kublai orders Marco to cease his travels and instead engage the great Khan in an endless chess match. But this does not slow Marco down. The movement of the chess pieces becomes the narrative of the invisible cities. We come at last to Berenice, the unjust city, which has a just city within it, and an unjust within that, and on and on. Berenice is then a sequence of cities, just and unjust, but all the future Berenices are present already, wrapped one within the other, confined, crammed, inextricable. And since that is where we all live, Marco Polo ceases. There are then no more invisible cities. One final dialogue between Kublai and Marco remains. Where, Kublai asks, are the promised lands? Why has Marco not spoken of New Atlantis, Utopia, the City of the Sun, New Harmony, and all the other cities of redemption? For these parts I could not draw a route on the map or set a date for the landing, Marco replies. But already the great Khan, leafing through his atlas, comes upon the cities of nightmares and maledictions, Babylon, Yahoo Land, Brave New World, and the others. In despair, the aged Kublai states his nihilism. The current draws us, at last, to the infernal city. Wonderfully, the last words are given to Polo, who speaks for what is still hopeful in the reader. We are indeed already in the inferno of the living. We can accept it, and so cease to be conscious of it. But there is a better way, and it might be called the wisdom of Italo Calvino. Seek and learn to recognize who and what, in the midst of inferno, are not inferno. Then make them endure, give them space. Calvino's advice tells us again how to read and why. Be vigilant. Apprehend and recognize the possibility of the good. Help it to endure. Give it space in your life. Summary observations. It is useful to consider modern short stories as dividing themselves into rival traditions, Chekhovian and Borgesian. Flannery O'Connor, despite surface appearances, is as much in Chekhov's tradition as Italo Calvino is in the rival line of Kafka and Borges. The Chekhovian short story is not fantasy, however outrageous it turns in the work of Flannery O'Connor. Hemingway, who wanted to be Tolstoy, is very Chekhovian, as was